You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, February 17th, 2015. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape. Steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. That's right, ladies and gentlemen. This, well, it's sort of like vacation week. It was going to be vacation week, as I generally follow the public school vacation, well, at least during the year, during the school year anyways, schedule. But alas, I am off in Hollywood, making it big. Well, not so much making it big, but appearing on Marc Maron's IFC TV show. Yes, he has one. I know. You didn't know about it. It's all right. Still going to be fun. Marc is going to project upon me all the things that he thinks that I think about him. Get it wrong. I've already seen the script. In fact, today's a travel day, so we're not actually shooting yet. But we recorded for you new content. On the program today, Joseph Hickman, author of Murder at Camp Delta, A Staff Sergeant's Pursuit of the Truth About Guantanamo Bay. This is an incredible story that this former Marine has to tell about Guantanamo. It is really, it's really something. We will play the interview in just a moment, just to let you know for the rest of the week, we will have some repeat content and some new content, some days with member content, others not. But I will also, for members, hopefully be able to post a dispatch from the set this week. But listen to this interview with Joseph Hickman. We'll be back with recorded content tomorrow. Again, no live show. Obviously, if you're hearing this, don't call in. All right. Here's that interview now. We are back on the Majority Report. On the phone with me, Joseph Hickman, a former U.S. Army staff sergeant. He was stationed in Guantanamo Bay from March 2006 to March 2007. He is now a senior fellow at Seton Hall Law School's Center for Policy and Research. And his book, Murder at Camp Delta, was just published in January. Joe, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Will you, let's start with, just to get a sense of your background. What is, your military history, really spanned the vast majority of your adult life?
Yes, I was in the Marine Corps. I joined the Marine Corps at age 18, and I spent 4 years in the Marines, and then I got out for a little while and did my own thing in the civilian world, where I was an operations manager for a large security firm, which I was doing security operations for Fort Detrick, Camp David, and other high-profile places. And then I missed the military, I missed the camaraderie, and went back in the Army and did another three-year tour there. And off and on, I was in the Army for 14 years prior to going to Guantanamo.
And at one point you served with the NSA, too, is that correct?
That was, yes, that was when I was in the Marine Corps. I was attached to a unit that was working out of the NSA at Fort Meade.
And when you re-enlisted, or were you first stationed at Guantanamo?
I re-enlisted after 9/11. I was older. I was actually, you know, in my late 30s. But I just thought, you know, after that attack, it affected me so much. I just thought I still had something to offer. So I joined the Maryland National Guard. And that was my third deployment with the Guard, was Guantanamo Bay. The other two were Germany and Japan.
And the deployment that you had in Germany and Japan, were they similarly? I mean, were they? I guess in any way, did you function in the same capacity in terms of being a guard or part of a rapid response team at the in those countries?
Both of those countries, I was actually embedded with the German military and the Japanese Defense Force. We were teaching tactics and sharing tactics with the German Army. And in the Japanese Defense Force, we were actually training the men to the 2,000 troops or 2,000 or so troops that were actually going to be deployed to Iraq at the time.
I see. And so how is it that, I mean, how is it that you ended up in Guantanamo? I mean, is this something? I mean, was there a skill set that determined where you would end up, or?
No, it was really, you know, units get called for different deployments, and the unit I was with at the time got the call to serve in Guantanamo.
Okay, and I mean, there was nothing. I assume. I mean. Tell me if I'm wrong, that you are not in a position to talk about what you did for the NSA. But was there anything, I mean, is there any crossover there? Is it fairly random? I guess my sense is at a place like Guantanamo, one would, and maybe this is just simply my ignorance, but one would anticipate that there would be, that it wouldn't be random necessarily that you would end up there, but maybe that's wrong.
No, unfortunately, it was absolutely random that unit was called for that deployment.
Well, tell us a little bit about, you know, what Guantanamo is. I mean, I think people have a vague notion, but I'm not sure that people really have a clear perspective on just what is at the Guantanamo base.
Well, Guantanamo, it's really split. It's really split in two different bases almost. One part is the guard force that watches the Cuban border, and the other is the detention facilities that are housed in a camp called Camp America. And that's where I was with the Camp America, where the detention facilities were.
How big, like physically, are these two, I guess, or this base within a base? Or I mean, just give us a sense of what the physicality is.
I think it's probably larger than most people would think it is, but it's also once you're there for a year, I served a year there, it gets small really fast.
Right, I imagine.
They have, on the main part of the base, they have Navy Lodge, which is like a hotel room, Naval Exchange, which is similar to a strip mall, McDonald's, bowling alleys, all the amenities from home. But when you get into the Camp America, where I was, it's very different. It's not big at all. It just houses those detainee camps. And, of course, the whole border side seems extremely large at first. But, like I said, it shrinks when you're there for a while.
So, I mean, are we talking about the entire base? Tens of acres, hundreds of acres, and then the Camp America, is that, how much smaller is that? Can you give us a sense?
I would say the base, really don't quote me on this, is hundreds of acres, if not more. The Camp America, where the detainee facilities are, I would say... At most a square mile.
Wow. Okay. So that it's significantly smaller part of the base. And is there there a sense that everything sort of focuses around that, or are there other things going on, and that's just one element there?
There's other things going on, but this is the most secure and secretive part of the base.
And what did you do, and you were stationed where? In Camp America or around it or what?
I was stationed in Camp America, but I had duties inside of Camp Delta, which was the main detainee holding facility at the time in Guantanamo.
So that, and is Camp Delta actually inside Camp America?
Yes.
Okay, so
yes.
There's like a series of concentric circles almost.
Yes.
And so you're in Camp America and in Camp Delta, and you got there in 2006?
Six. March of 2006, yes.
And so give me your sense of what your perspective was on I guess, Guantanamo at the time when you entered as you got there, and just what was your level of awareness as to who was there?
Well, but while I was training to go to Guantanamo, I was convinced that Guantanamo, the detention facilities there were needed. I felt it. I knew it was controversy, but I thought people just didn't understand. The war after 9/11 changed everything. We were fighting a different type of war that people just didn't understand. We needed a place like Guantanamo to hold the worst detainees in the world at. And I was all for it before I arrived. And then once I arrived, that view slowly changed, and that's what I reflect in my book, how my attitude and my beliefs about Guantanamo slowly evolved throughout the years.
And now I think it's going to become apparent as to why they evolved throughout the years. I wonder, like, when you first got there, did you have any contact with any of the prisoners? Did your attitudes towards the camp shift before we get to June, or I guess the events of June and subsequent? Did they shift in those first couple of months?
It shifted the first day that I was in a tower inside of Camp Delta, and able to overlook the detainees in the camp. The first thing I saw when I was in the towers was detainees held in 6x8 cells in open air cells, so they weren't temperature controlled, and the Cuban heat can really get to anyone.
Right.
These 6x8 cells, and I knew from what I was saying, that these men were held in these cells for years, since, you know, before I arrived. And they were able to receive 1 hour of rec time a week. And that 1 hour of rec time was just, they were taken out of their 6x8 cells and put in a 12x12 fenced-in area and able to just stand there. They had a soccer ball in the middle of this fenced-in area. They were able to play with the soccer ball, but alone. But they could, the soccer ball couldn't touch the fence. If it touched the fence, the guards would immediately end their rec time and put them back in their cell. It was, the smell that came out of this place was horrible, because they received two showers a week, and that's not enough in the Cuban sun. And they also, just the screams and the cries and the nightmares, and watching these men just pace back and forth in these 6x8 cells, or in the 12x12 cell, they would walk circles. It just reminded me of animals at a zoo. And I served before, I served as a prison guard in Baltimore before I went to Guantanamo. And I knew that this was a lot worse than even what's here in the States as far as the prison system. So I was shocked at first, and it was really the first place I ever started to question, okay, I'm a soldier. I took an oath to support and defend the Constitution of the United States. But I'm watching these men sitting in these cells for years without due process. Am I breaking my oath as a military man? That was the first thing that popped in my head. That night in that tower, I couldn't even look anymore. I would have to just look away from the camps, because it was just treating human beings that way was just absolutely wrong. I knew it right from the get-go.
And we should say, I mean, you know, you make it pretty clear in your book. I mean, your political orientation was such that you weren't the type of guy to necessarily have knee-jerk reactions, or I should say sympathies with prisoners. And I mean that's a fair statement, right?
Yes, I'm a Republican, and Ronald Reagan is my favorite president. It's that's the way it was, you know. I believe we were doing right. And then when I went there and actually saw what I saw, I knew something was dreadfully wrong.
And you didn't know at this point, I mean, were you aware at this point of how many people were being held there, where at that point, I mean, this is 2006 now, so I imagine the list of, I don't know how many prisoners were there at that time, and initially it was about 800, so maybe around that number at that time. Were you aware of how many were already basically found to not be of any type of intelligence value from the perspective of those who were holding them, was this just strictly like, you're presuming these people belong there, but just you had an issue with the way that you were watching how they were treated?
I was aware when I was there, when I landed on the island, there was 485 detainees held at Guantanamo, which we were overseeing. I know that it was open source how many were there and how many were released, but I never read about that, because that was the other side of my point of view, and I didn't even give them a consideration of being right at the time. I just knew I had 485 detainees, and I was a sergeant, and I was in charge of men, and it was my responsibility to make sure we did our jobs and made sure these people were detained properly.
I want to talk about what happened in May, following March, that you get there. But before we do, when you were looking over and you were seeing that, and you were struck by the conditions there, I mean, did you share that with anybody else? I mean, do you go to one of your fellow guards, or do you go to one of the enlisted men and say, can I get a reality check here? Is this wrong? Or what do you do in that situation? Do you go to one of your superiors?
I didn't go to one of my superiors. They knew exactly what was going on down there. Amongst the troops in my squad, we did talk about it and talked about how it just was a cruel place.
I mean, was it the sense that, I mean, were you, I mean, where would you put yourself in the context of just how much people sort of were taken aback by what they came upon? In other words, did you feel at the time like I could isolate myself a little bit if I bring this up too much, or did you say like, wow, these other guys are reacting that much worse to it? I'm just curious as to what the general feeling was and where you fit in on the spectrum, I guess.
I would say the 5 to 10% of us thought that it was an awful place. The others were true believers. They really had in their head that these were the worst of the worst. They were killers and terrorists, and if they had the chance, they would slit our throats. But what I saw just, and I'm speaking of experience from, like I said, from working in a prison, it just wasn't so. These people that we were guarding weren't physically, or most of them, weren't physically or mentally capable of being any type of threat against the United States. Now, I'm not naive. I know there is some down in Guantanamo that are truly bad people. But I would say the majority were not, and they were not being treated well at all.
So tell us what happened on May 18th of 2006, because this is, I think, you know, this, at least to me, illustrates that, you know, you still had a job to do, and this was not, and it was a dangerous job.
Yeah, May 18th was a riot that occurred in Camp 4 of Camp Delta. Camp Delta was broken up into four different camps. And we had disturbance earlier in Camp 1 where we were told that there was detainees there hoarding medicine, hiding them in their Korans. And we had to go in and cell extract these detainees so these Korans could be inspected. Well, a long story short, we didn't have to go in. Nothing happened, but the camp was extremely tense that day. It was resolved other ways. And then later on that day, we get a call of disturbance in Camp 4. I was on the quick reaction force that day, which handled any disturbances in the camp. Well, I sent my men and myself to Camp 4, and we're lining up. Camp 4 was a very dangerous place because it was communal living for the detainees. They were allowed to, they had 10-man rooms, so they all lived together. When I got up to the door of one of the cell blocks, which holds 10 detainees, a guard yelled, "He's hanging himself, he's hanging himself." Well, I have 10 men on my QRF. We run inside of the cell block, only to be tripping all over the place because the detainees lined the floor with soap and feces and anything else we would slip on. And it ended up being a huge brawl, and there was no one hanging themselves in the cell. I don't know why we were even in there. But it ended up being a riot, a massive riot, 10 detainees against 10 guards. And at one point, one of the detainees had one of my guys on the ground, and he had a shank in his hand ready to really do some serious harm to my guard. So I gave the order to fire on the detainees. It was the first time in Guantanamo any detainees was ever shot with non-lethal rounds. Unfortunately, I had to make the decision to fire at lethal range, which means under 10 feet, 10 to 12 feet away is considered safe. I had to give the order within 5 to 6 feet to save my guard and basically end the riot as fast as I could because I knew someone was really going to get hurt.
And so what happened to that detainee who was fired upon?
Well, actually, three detainees were fired upon, and they were all taken to the medical clinic and treated for their injuries. They all were okay. They did have some rubber buckshot in them, but they all survived. It was a horrible experience, though.
And the guard that yelled, "He's hanging himself." Did you ever go back to that guard? And what was going on there, or how did that happen?
It was completely a false order. I don't know why. When we arrived there in Camp 4, Colonel Baumgartner, the Joint Detention Group commander, was there. There was about 200 Navy guards standing outside in formation, and it seemed like we were just sent in to really stir things up. It was awful. And the detainees that did give up in the riot, we would escort them outside to the Navy guards, and the Navy guards would just put a beat down on them. And it was, you know, we were in the fight. It sounds odd, but we were thinking, you don't deserve to do this to these guys. You know, what are you doing?
Well, I mean, did you get the sense? I mean, I guess, you know, what strikes me about this event is it sounds like this was that if not instigated, that an opportunity was seen to create a problem.
I think it was instigated, and it was instigated to create a problem. Absolutely.
And so what was going on in the camp at that time in terms of the detainees? Is this during one of the hunger strikes?
Well, this created a massive hunger strike. Well, I say massive. There was one larger than that a year prior, or the summer prior. But this created about 90 people went on a hunger strike because of this incident. And when you're down there as a guard like I am, I'm just looking through a small view. I don't see the big picture of what really is happening there. I don't know why the command did so many things they did. But from my narrow view, I think I described it pretty well in the book that this is we were used to really for another purpose.
And I mean, just that purpose being to heighten the tension.
To heighten the tension and to, you know, there's small battles that we don't even see going on in our position where they could be battling with some of the leaders of the hunger strikers, and we're moved in to agitate and to create chaos for these guys, and we're not even aware that's what we're doing because we're not, you know, we're just being used.
Right. You don't see the context there. So, okay, now let's go to June 9th, less than a month later. This evening is the night when supposedly three prisoners who all three of whom we should say were men: Yasser Talal Zahrani of Yemen, Salah Ahmed Al Salami, and Mani Shaman Al Utabi, I guess. I may be not doing justice to the names. Forgive me. From Saudi Arabia. These three men, ranging in age from 20 to 37, were also three of those who essentially had been determined at that time to have provided to be worth no of no intelligence value, I should say, to the U.S. government. Did you tell us what happened that night? Tell us, did you know those prisoners, or I mean, did you know any of the prisoners at this point, like sort of personally? Did you know their names, or did you, you know, recognize them, or were they just, there was 400 some odd prisoners there and you just saw the jumpsuit?
Well, no, I didn't recognize any of these guys. I didn't know them before June 9th. They were in Camp 1, so they wore the tan uniform, I guess, which was a privilege. You get out of the jumpsuit and go into the tan if you earn it or something like that. It was a weird way they had of ruling things. But they had tan suits on. And that night, I just went on duty. I was sergeant of the guard, which means I was responsible for a lot of the positions inside of Camp Delta and on the perimeter of Camp America. That night I first went to the tower inside of Camp Delta called Tower 1, which overlooks the entrance, the detainee medical clinic, and Camp 1. It has a clear unobstructed view of all three. And less than 35 meters away from the detainee medical clinic. That night, I the first thing I saw was a white van that we called the paddy wagon. The paddy wagon was a van that transported detainees from one camp to another or military commissions or anywhere they needed to go. It was a small cube box in the back they would put the detainee in and transport him. That night I saw the paddy wagon come into the gate, go up to Camp 1, back up to Camp 1, take a detainee out of Camp 1 Alpha Block, put him into the paddy wagon, and leave Camp America and go towards the exit, or leave Camp Delta and go towards the exit of Camp America. About 20 minutes later, the van arrived back. It repeated the same thing. And then I would say 20 to 30 minutes later after that, the van came back a third time. I was really curious of what was going on right now at this time because it was a Friday evening. There was no military commissions in process, and this van was leaving Camp America. So I was wondering where it was going. So when he came back in the third time, I went to the exit of Camp America just to see where they were going to go after that. If they went straight, they were going to the main part of the base. Well, when they left Camp America, about 100 meters past Camp America, they made a left. And that left turn, it's only two places it could have went in 2006 at that time. It could have went to the beach where soldiers go for recreation time, or it could have went to a facility that me and my fellow soldiers discovered, and we call it Camp No. Camp No was later verified as a CIA dark site. It was a black facility.
So there's just basically a building that you guys are vaguely aware of. Is that encircled by fencing as well, or is it just a building that nobody goes into? I mean, when you guys are you head down to the beach and you go by that building, or what does it look like, or is that just
you can't see it on you can't see it from the road? There's heavy brush covering the road. You can't see the building from there. It's there. You do see a small road that leads to it, but you can just see the road itself. You can't see what's up that road. One day when me and my soldiers were on patrol, we were looking for, it was extremely hot, we were looking for a place to pull over and get under some shade and rest for a little bit. And we actually found this place when we really took the Humvee into the brush, and we found a fence line that said no pictures, no trespassing, a whole bunch of no's. And we automatically got curious of what this was, so we followed the fence line, and we were able to see the building, which once we saw the building, it looked just like any other detainee facility on the camp, but this one was not on the maps and just not on any in the records at all.
Okay, so you watch over the course of an hour and a half or so the paddy wagon, more or less, pick up three prisoners and bring them at least in the direction of what you call Camp No. And you are at this point, are you in Camp America still, or are you outside of Camp America, which would basically put you in the, I guess, in the broader base? Where are you located and what happens next?
Well, when I saw him make the left turn, I was at the exit, which was called ACP Roosevelt. I was at the entrance and exit point of Camp America. Later on that evening, about 11:30, I'm making my rounds at all the different posts I'm in charge of. I make my way to the Sally Port, which is the entrance of Camp Delta, and Tower 1, which is the tower I explained earlier, which has the supervisor of the towers in there. That's why I always went to that tower. I went up there and I saw the paddy wagon return, and this time it didn't go to Camp 1. It backed up to the detainee medical clinic's entrance. It opened its back doors, and I had an obstructed view by them because of the doors, but they were taking something inside of the detainee medical clinic. So about 20 minutes later, all the lights come on in Camp Delta. There's a siren going off. People are all, everyone's running towards the detainee medical clinic. And it was just absolute chaos. The lights are like stadium lights. So I saw a Navy corpsman that I knew outside, and I went over to her, and I, outside the detainee medical clinic, I said, "What happened?" She said, "Three detainees killed themselves. They stuffed rags down their throats." And I said, "How did this happen?" She couldn't speak much. She was really upset. And then I saw Colonel Baumgartner a little later on. He told me we were going to have a meeting at 7 a.m. at the theater on base to talk about all this. So at 7 a.m. the next morning, we go to the meeting, and Colonel Baumgartner tells us that three detainees killed themselves by stuffing rags down their throats, but we may hear something different in the news, and we're not to dispute it. And he gave us a direct order not to speak to anyone at home, family members, or media about what happened there.
Wow. And so so what happens then? I mean, you guys walk away and go, that's strange, I guess. And then,
it was strange. It was Guantanamo, though, so everything was sort of strange. And then later on that day, I was watching CNN in this chow hall, and I see a story, and Admiral Harris is speaking on there, saying that all three detainees hung themselves in their cells, and it was some sort of form of asymmetrical warfare against us. I knew right away that there was no way three detainees could have hung themselves in their cells and been transported to the detainee medical clinic without my tower guards or my guards posted in the entrance of Camp Delta, which was literally 20 feet away from the detainee medical clinic, without them not seeing it or me seeing it, because I was in Tower 1 at the time. It was no way nobody hung themselves in their cells and was transported to the clinic.
At least from those cells, right? I mean, you saw the paddy wagon come back in, but it had not come from the detention cells that you could see.
It was no way it could have happened from the detention cells in Camp Delta. The only way those detainees could have got into that medical clinic was from the paddy wagon.
I see.
There's no other way.
So you at that point realized that if they committed suicide, they didn't do it where they supposedly did it, and they're brought in there. And so then what happens? That's the next day.
Well, I went to all my guards just to make sure that I wasn't crazy. I asked them, you know, you were in Tower 1, you had two guards in Tower 1. Did you see anybody transported to the medical clinic from one of the cell blocks? They said it absolutely didn't happen. Checked with three guards at the entrance. Never happened. I checked with a guard that was actually in a tower in Camp 1, overlooking the walkway. Direct view. He said it never happened. So I was very suspicious, but I figured, you know, there's going to be an investigation. This is Guantanamo. And when they come around, we'll tell them what happened.
And so you're anticipating an investigation from the Naval Criminal Investigation Services. And did they ever come around?
Never did. Never questioned us. Which is odd because, you know, the towers are the eye in the sky. They see everything. Why wouldn't the tower guards be questioned? Or the three guards I had posted right by the detainee medical clinic within 20 feet away. Why wouldn't they question those three either? So it was very suspicious. And at this point, Guantanamo is wearing on all of us. We are seeing abuses so much. One of my guards actually tried to report an abuse to the higher-ups, and he gets scalded and he gets threatened, and the person that he reported got promoted.
Wow.
So we were really fed up, and we just wanted to leave the island at this time.
So has
and
the
I wanted to put Guantanamo behind me.
Has the dynamic changed from the time that you moved in? I mean, you said when you first got there, you saw within a day that the treatment was wrong, and you felt like you were in. There was only 5 to 10% of your crew essentially that was with you on this. By the time you're a couple months now, I guess 6 months into it or so. And after this event and this and witnessing, you know, getting the message that if you complain, you're going to get in trouble and the person you complain about is going to get promoted. Has that dynamic shifted? Are there more of you essentially that are having this feeling?
There's more that are questioning, but I really just my squad was part of that 5 or 10%. We were all, we were all guys from the inner city. We were guys that's been around, and a couple of us worked in prisons before, so we had a different perspective on how things should be, you know. And so they were always questioning that and always thought it was an unfair place. But yeah, more started questioning, but no one wanted to stir waves. They just wanted to get off the aisle and do their duty and go home.
So you leave in March of 2007, and this is just stuff it sounds like that you wanted to forget about. And then one day you're watching the news and you realize you can't forget about it. What were you watching that day?
There was another suicide, supposed suicide in Guantanamo, and it just brought everything back. And I started questioning, was this the same situation that I went through? Did this guy, was it really suicide? Because I knew that there was nobody hung themselves in Gitmo. For that to happen, they would have all three detainees would have had to tie their hands and feet together. This is the way the government explained it. They would have had to tie their hands and feet together. They would have had to stuff rags down their throat to the point of gagging, put a mask over their face, hang a noose from the ceiling or the side of the cell block wall, jump into that noose, and hang themselves all simultaneously without a guard seeing it, which the guards are required by the standard operating procedure to check on the detainee every 3 minutes. Yet when they say they found them, they were hanging for several hours.
Hmm.
So it was, besides what I witnessed, this is what I found out later would have actually had to have happened if the government's story was true.
So you watch this news report, it brings it all back, you realize that you can't, this is just not going to go away. At least in your mind anyways. Do you make a conscious decision at that point? Like, I'm going to be a whistleblower. I'm going to go to the media. I'm going to go to the Department of Justice. What do you do?
I wanted to go to, well, at that time, it was clear that President Bush wasn't going to be in office anymore. And I knew that I couldn't go to the Bush administration with this. It was either going to be Senator McCain or President Obama take office. So I knew that this was the right time because both were against Guantanamo. So I made a decision I was going to bring this forward. So I didn't want to go to the media. I wanted to go to the Justice Department. So I went to a lawyer at Seton Hall Law School, Professor Mark Denbo, and told him everything, and I wanted to figure out how to get this to the Justice Department.
And what did he advise at that point?
Well, he went to Washington, D.C. and spoke to him, and then they decided they wanted to speak to me, so they, two FBI agents and two attorneys from the Justice Department came to Seton Hall Law School, and I spoke to them there for about 3 hours.
And this is when did you have this conversation? Was it at this point, it was the Obama administration?
It was the Obama administration. They just took office.
All right, so you have this interview from representatives from the Department of Justice, and then what?
Well, they seemed very interested. I talked to them for 3 hours. They were asking a lot of questions. And when I about 10 or 11 months went by, we haven't heard from them. I also gave them names and of seven other witnesses that came forward besides myself that wanted to report this. And so one day Mark Denbo called about 11 months later and said, hey, where are we at on this investigation? And one of the DOJ attorneys said, we can't confirm all of Hickman's story, so it's basically over. And Professor Denbo said, well, you know, I gave you a list of these witnesses. I've spoke to them. You haven't even talked to them. How can you end this investigation? The next morning, the DOJ went and spoke to those people for about a half hour and called them back and said they were closing it because they just didn't have enough evidence to support what I was saying.
Hmm. And so at that point now, it's close to 2010. And this is where you decide to go to tell your story to Scott Horton, who
yes.
has been a recent guest on this program, who at that time was writing at Harper's Magazine.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I told Scott everything, and he did his own investigation into it, found a few more things, and he wrote that piece in Harper's. It went on to win a National Magazine Award, I believe.
It did. And so, I mean, at one point, like, do you keep thinking at this point, like, okay, now there's going to be some investigation into it? I mean, so the piece comes out. You, at that point, are, in many ways, your account is attacked by the Naval Criminal Investigation Service by saying that you really didn't have access to Camp Delta and you would have never known. You weren't in a position to judge whether or not these prisoners would have come to Camp Delta into the infirmary, I guess. Tell me what that feels like when you think that you are delivering this story, it's going to get out in the public, and now we're finally going to see some measure of accountability. Or what is it that you were looking for, too, I guess?
Well, I really wanted another investigation, a legitimate investigation done on this case. We read the NCIS documents, me and Seton Hall Law School, and did a report on it called Death in Camp Delta. And if you read the NCIS investigation, there's so many flaws in it. And that's what I cover in my book, on how many mistakes they made in their investigation. And some of them, it even looks purpose, like it was done on purpose. So I really wanted another investigation done. What the NCIS said was I was a perimeter guard. There was no way I could have seen what I witnessed. That's not true. I was inside Camp Delta that evening. I did have duties outside in the perimeter, but I also had 50% of my duties were inside of Camp Delta. So I don't know where they got that information, if they got that from the JTF Gitmo Command, but it's absolutely not true. And it's proven not true. I don't know, but they insisted on that. And actually, the position I had where I had post inside of Camp Delta and outside of Camp Delta was a benefit because I could see what was happening in the camp, and then I could leave the camp and go to the perimeter and see where that van actually turned.
So, I mean, so let me ask you this. I mean, has there been, I mean, aside from the fact that they basically say they try and impeach your credibility in that respect, has there been any other type of pushback? I mean, were there times where you were actually sort of afraid for your well-being? I mean, you know, I'm trying to get a sense of just how worried they were about this information coming out.
Well, they were definitely worried about it. When we told the DOJ that we were going to the media, the press on this, they definitely didn't want the story out when we went to Harper's. They didn't want us to talk to anyone. But we felt they didn't do their job, so we had to do this because I still want something done, you know. I was awful worried. I gave up a CIA black site, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And but instead, you know, the DOJ, if you ever notice, they'll either really attack somebody or they'll totally ignore them, like they're not even on the face of the earth. And if they attacked me, they had quite a few problems. I'm a Boy Scout on paper. There is nothing. My military career is terrific, and I have you know, the time of those deaths. I was rated. I was called NCO of the quarter, which means I was the best non-commissioned officer in my unit at the time when those deaths occurred. So they could have came after me, but maybe the best strategy for them was to ignore me and hope it went away, and I would stop my pursuit of it, you know, my pursuit.
And you didn't. And I wonder, and obviously that's where your book has come out of that. But and I wonder, the other guys in that unit, I mean, are what do they say? I mean, are they supportive? Are there other guys who want to come out? Is there have you been ever approached by, let's say, a member of the Senate Intelligence Committee, let's say, or for congressional hearings? I mean, has no politician come to you and have you made any attempts to speak to a politician to see if there could be hearings about this, or is it just nobody's interested?
No, I spoke to Senator Russ Feingold at the time, and Senator Russ Feingold was very interested and really pursued this up until the time he was beaten by Ron Johnson,
right.
Rob Johnson or whatever his name, Ron Johnson. But he contacted me right before he got out of left office, and he told me that there were three things in his career at the Senate that he regretted not getting to the bottom of, and my story was one of those things. He just wanted to let me know that.
Interesting. And so what happens now? I mean, you've just the Senate torture report was released. This isn't that doesn't cover necessarily the torture that well, let me ask you this. You don't your book is entitled Murder at Camp Delta. You don't by the end, claim murder because you don't have a perpetrator. Or do you have in your head the idea of who they might be? Or is it you just have no idea? You just don't believe that these men committed suicide?
Well, I don't come to that solid conclusion at the end on purpose. I lay out the facts of what happened, the investigation we did on the NCIS report, and we lay out, you know, the facts and what the NCIS say happened, and I let the reader decide what they want their conclusion to be. I do know that, you know, the place they were taken to was Camp No. And a lot of my critics, when the Harper's Magazine piece came out, said, well, this Camp No, he calls. He has no idea if it's a CIA black site. There's no other CIA black sites down there. And then 3 years later, it was proven by Associated Press that, yeah, it was a CIA black site there, and it was Camp No. They called it Penny Lane, but it was the same exact site. So that was verified. Who killed him? It was a CIA facility. I can only draw certain conclusions, but I can't name names, so I leave that for the reader to decide.
You can't name names because you don't have the evidence, or you just simply don't know who was in that facility?
I don't know who was in that facility at the time working. I just know they were taken there that night. They weren't taken to the beach to enjoy the ocean. You know, it was definitely they were taken to a CIA facility that night, and they were brought back, and they were not alive when they were brought back.
Is it your sense that they were brought there to be killed, or they were brought there to be tortured and died?
That I don't know. I know that they were that after the riot, there was a massive hunger strike. All three of these guys were the leaders of the hunger strike, along with another detainee, a British detainee named Shakir Amir, and all four were tortured that night. And three died.
Now, how do you know that all four were tortured? Because Shakir Amir did not die. So tell us what we know about Shakir Amir that leads you to believe that all four were tortured.
Shakir Amir, he wrote an affidavit. There's an affidavit from his attorney that said on June the 9th he was beaten. He had his airway obstructed. He had a mask put over his face. There was constant pressure point, people pushing on his pressure points. He was tortured that night for several hours, and he goes into detail in the affidavit of what happened.
And yet, Russ Feingold is no longer obviously in the Senate, but has there been no one else who has approached you? No other politician? Have you attempted to reach out to politicians and been essentially...
Well, the ones I reached out to were replaced by the big grassroots Tea Party movement. Congressman Delahunt was very interested in this story. We are going to be reaching out again. You know, we just wanted some to be able to lay out some solid evidence in front of one of these guys and say, hey, look, I wrote this book, and what are you going to do about it? This is straightforward. We show that the NCIS, we destroyed the NCIS, me and Seton Hall, destroyed the NCIS report in my book.
In the course of your research, give me a sense of where you think that, where you think the fact that those four were tortured fits. In other words, was that part of a larger program at this black site? And was that black site part of a larger torture program?
Oh, it was definitely there. Guantanamo was, through our research, we discovered that Guantanamo was mainly set up to experiment with interrogation techniques to figure out what worked and what didn't. We found out that these people there, most of them weren't the worst of the worst detainees on the planet. They were, a lot of them were caught by bounty. They were farmers. This was a battle lab, as two generals explained it. It was America's battle lab to see what worked and what didn't. So yes, it was. They died that night in a CIA facility on a base that is made to see what works and what doesn't.
Joseph Hickman, former U.S. Army staff sergeant, author of Murder at Camp Delta, thank you so much for telling us about your story, and thank you for being so adamant about getting your story out. It's an incredibly important one, and I appreciate the tenacity in which you've dedicated your life to this, and I appreciate it.
Yes, and if you notice, I dedicated the book to Talil al-Zarani, who's the father of one of the detainees, Yasser al-Zarani, who was captured when he was 16 years old in Pakistan. And his father always questioned the U.S. government's what they said, how his son died, and I wanted him to see what I say to hopefully give him some sort of answers in a disturbing way.
Have you talked to him? Since your book has come out, what does he say? Have you had a conversation with him about what you found?
No, but I know who his attorneys are, and they said he was actually a brigadier general in the Riyadh Police Department, and when he got his son, when he received his son's body, he said it was so battered and bruised there was no way that it was a death by hanging, and he couldn't prove it because the U.S. government never returned the throats of the detainees to the families, so they couldn't. There couldn't be anything proven. But he always questioned it, and I just thought, you know, that his story always bothered me the most because he was a minor when he was picked up in the global war on terror.
Wait, I'm sorry. They didn't return the throats?
They did not. When all three detainees, when their bodies were sent back to the families, the parts that were missing was the throats of all three detainees. So if there was ever a second autopsy done, you could not prove whether they hung themselves or not because the pieces were missing.
Jeez. Oh, Joseph Hickman, again, the book is Murder at Camp Delta. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, sir.